A. Simpson and his colleagues discovered, which makes it even harder for couples to get along when the working models of two romantic partners are different. After measuring the attachment orientation of each individual, Simpson's team had each member of the couple identify a significant conflict in the relationship and, choosing one from each list, had the couple engage in a conflict resolution discussion, which was then videotaped. Right after the discussion, each person rated how supportive or emotionally distant he or she had been. They were then asked the same question 1 week later. What the researchers found was that the more distress there was in the conflict discussion, the more the individual's working models acted as a filter. Anxious people rated themselves as being more supportive when they remembered the discussion than they did initially. Avoidant people reported themselves as being more emotionally distant. What individuals respond to in relationships is not what they actually said or did during an interaction with their partner, the researchers surmised. Rather, what they respond to is memories of the interaction filtered through their working models. This research explains why it is that if we have, indeed, partnered with someone whose internalized scripts are very different from our own, the discord is likely to be endless, with little resolution in sight without some kind of intervention. Some questions to ask yourself. Is there an underlying pattern in the relationships I choose to be in? Are my reactions and responses basically the same in every relationship, no matter how different the person is? Do I tend to be attracted to the same kind of person over and over again? How long do my relationships, whether they're friendships or romantic liaisons, last? Do they tend to end in the same ways? Distinguishing other people's attachment styles. Our working models don't just act as a filter on memory, as that study showed. They're fully operational every time we connect with anyone. Our understanding of someone's motivations, our interpretation of their words and behavior, our reading of their emotions and motions are poured through the sieve of our working models. Unless you begin to be aware of your own attachment style, anxious or avoidant, you are working from cue cards in a language you don't speak. If your relationships aren't working for you, the chances are good that you're choosing the wrong partners without understanding why. Unfortunately, both the limitations of our working models and the cultural depiction of romantic love often interact on an unconscious level to ensure some pretty disastrous choices and consequences. From Romeo and Juliet to 50 Shades of Grey, romance is portrayed as all-consuming, obliterating the boundaries between yourself and the other. But as science knows, a healthy, sustaining, and truly intimate relationship depends on two people being at once both interdependent yet capable of autonomy. Paradoxically, as the work of Brooke Feeney has shown, by being both dependent and autonomous, people actually become more empowered and independent, setting goals for themselves they might not otherwise have. There's evidence that this interdependence isn't just metaphoric or a matter of living lives that are intertwined on many practical levels. As Daniel Wegner and his co-authors write, "But on hearing even the simplest conversation between intimates, it becomes remarkably apparent that their thoughts, too, are interconnected. Together, they think about things in ways that they would not alone." These relationships are those of partners who have a secure base. They are skilled communicators, want intimacy and closeness, are good at managing and diffusing conflict, can manage their emotions, and aren't given to game playing. The sad truth is that the insecurely attached daughter, especially if she is looking for passion and romance, accompanied by the strains of "someday my prince will come," is not likely to be attracted to someone securely attached. That reasonable and stable way of dealing with things can, when filtered through the sieve, look dull, passionless, and even boring. Secure people don't create a lot of drama, and all too often, insecurely attached people mistake drama for passion or excitement. Instead, absent conscious awareness, it's much more likely that the unloved daughter will be attracted to someone who's insecurely attached himself. Even if she is attracted to someone secure, without awareness, there's unlikely to be a happy ending. Much of relationship stress, not to mention discord, fracture, and rupture, can be understood as the result of people with very different attachment styles getting together. Put two securely attached people together and you can cue the violins, and all things considered, they are good to go. Of course, this doesn't mean that they won't ever disagree or fight, or that they will necessarily stay together forever. It does mean that they have a home court advantage in terms of being able to communicate, a shared goal of needing and wanting real intimacy, and are less likely to engage in some of the more toxic behaviors, demand withdrawal, belittling their partner, making criticism highly personal, and the like, that bedevil relationships and are, according to John Gottman and other experts, the fuel for divorce. But combine one securely attached person with an anxiously attached person and get ready for some real challenges, and don't forget to fasten your seatbelts. That was the case for Mike and Susie, who had been dating for 2 years. Mike had been doing his best to quell Susie's constant need for reassurance and her anxiety about whether he really loved her. When his work required him to travel 10 days out of every month, Mike suggested they move in together as a sign of his commitment. But living together didn't help. Susie would call or text him during working hours, even though he told her he couldn't respond. When he didn't answer, she would get progressively more wound up. Their arguments became constant, covering the same ground over and over, with Susie complaining that she wasn't important to him, that she needed to hear from him immediately, and Mike saying that he was doing all that he could and that she was being crazy and that he felt suffocated, until finally Mike moved out and ended the relationship. Of course, the ending might have been different had Susie understood how her own emotional history animated her present. She might have recognized her behavior as prompted by old triggers rather than things Mike was actually doing or saying. A secure man may initially be attracted to an avoidant partner. She may seem fiercely independent, even mysterious and a challenge, but will conclude, sooner or later, that the thrill of the chase isn't worth it, and that his needs aren't being met in terms of intimacy and sharing. But the real tinderbox of mismatches is that of the anxiously attached with the avoidantly attached. It's a predictable disaster in the making, with one person reacting with supercharged neediness, clingy behavior, angst, and protest anger, and the other, already inclined to keep at a distance in relationship, feeling the need to run for the hills while being content to play the game, at least for a while. The avoidant may like the feeling of control or the rush of power that pushing a needy person around can give some people. Each person in the relationship, in this case, locates his or her need for intimacy and understanding of what constitutes closeness at opposite ends of the spectrum. Luckily, there's no shortage of excellent research and information on attachment styles. And perhaps the key to either disentangling yourself from a bad fit relationship or seeing if it can possibly be salvaged is understanding the motivations that underlie the behaviors of the anxiously and avoidantly attached. Here are some of the characteristics that science has discovered. Anxious and avoidant people have sex for different reasons. That's exactly what a study by Dory A. Schachner and Philip R. Shaver clarified. Previous research showed that avoidant people were less likely to fall in love, more likely to play games and manipulate, and preferred non-committal, casual sex. Additionally, an earlier study by these authors showed that while avoidants were likely to try to poach someone else's guy or gal, it was only for the purpose of short-term sex and self-aggrandizement. In this study, Schachner and Shaver hypothesized and showed that avoidant people would be motivated to have sex for status-related reasons or to maintain control. In contrast, anxious individuals were motivated to have sex because of their fear of abandonment and need to feel valued by their partner. In this scenario, having sex is a way of tamping down fear and feeling cared for. It's interesting that, albeit for wholly different reasons, both the anxious and the avoidant see sex as being about the self, not the partner or the dyad. That observation is borne out and underscored by a study conducted by Gerrit Birnbaum and others. They experience sexual activity differently, with different consequences for a relationship. The Birnbaum study looked beyond the motives for having sex and focused instead on how the anxious and the avoidant experience sex and how, for each, sexual activity connects to relationship. In this case, the participants ranged in age from 17 to 48. What's interesting about this line of inquiry is that, as the authors note, while it's true that empirical evidence links sexual satisfaction to the quality and stability of a romantic relationship, clinical evidence suggests that harmonious couples can have relatively distressed sexual interactions, whereas other couples have turbulent relationships but great sex. They go on to write that a theoretical framework for understanding the role sex plays in romantic relationship, particularly the interplay between sexual activity and relational problems, appears to be lacking, and they suggest that attachment styles might provide one. The results were illuminating. Their first study had participants self-report scales of attachment orientation and then answer questions about sexual experience, relational issues, sex-related issues, and feelings and thoughts about pleasure. They found that highly anxious people reported focusing on their own needs while wanting their partner's emotional involvement, but also reported averse feelings during sexual intercourse and doubts about being loved. Avoidant people reported low levels of pleasure and pleasure-related feelings and strong aversion feelings during sexual intercourse. They, too, were focused on their own needs. In the second, smaller study, 50 participants kept a diary for 42 days, reporting on both sexual activity and relationship quality each day, as well as their feelings and thoughts after having sex. Not altogether surprisingly, a good sexual experience, especially among women, decreased relational anxiety, while a not-so-good one increased it. Either way, the authors noted that, for the anxiously attached, sex functioned as a barometer for the quality of the relationship. That wasn't true for avoidants, for whom both good sex and bad sex alike did not affect their view of the relationship. This led the researchers to conclude that avoidants have sex for relationship-irrelevant reasons. So much for trying to increase a feeling of intimacy with an avoidant. People who are insecurely attached are diminished by connection, not made stronger. This is perhaps the least discussed aspect of the bigger differences between the securely attached and those who aren't. As the work of Brooke Feeney makes clear, securely attached people who can depend on their partners actually become more independent and more able to take chances and risks because they know they will have support if there's a setback. For different reasons, the anxious and the avoidant don't experience this kind of personal growth through connection. Another study found similar results, this time focusing on energy. The researchers posited that because securely attached people are more skilled at managing negative emotion, and because managing negative emotion uses up energy and self-control, the securely attached would be more energetic. In contrast, the insecurely attached are using their energy to deal with triggers and activations of the attachment systems, whether that's, I'm being abandoned, or I'm being encroached. using primes on participants, visualizing either a securely attached person or an insecurely attached one, and then having the participants write about the experience and report on how energetic they felt. The researchers confirmed their hypothesis over a series of experiments. This actually makes perfect sense. Just spend a few minutes visualizing what you feel like with an emotionally demanding or withdrawn person, compared with someone who is available and grounded, and check your own energy levels. Yes, it's exhausting to either deal with emotional outbursts on the daily or do cartwheels 24/7 to get someone's attention. Questions to ask yourself about sex and intimacy. Think about your own reasons for having sex and the role sexual connection has played in your present or past relationships. Do you and partner argue about how much or how little sex you have, and has this been a pattern in previous relationships? Do you get anxious or feel rejected when your partner doesn't seem to want to make love? Or, alternatively, would you rather not have as much sex as your partner demands? Think about whether your sense of self is expanded or diminished by having sexual relations. That, too, is part of the work of distinguishing. If your lovers or friends have complained that you're too clingy or distant, or it's an observation you've heard frequently from others, it's important for you to consider whether the appraisal is correct. Confronting your own patterns of behavior isn't always easy, but it will help you achieve what you want, a relationship with the right balance of interdependence and autonomy. The key is to disarm the automatic nature of your responses, but that can only happen after you've distinguished, recognized, and understood your behaviors and what drives them. Examine your reactivity. Because this behavior is largely unconscious, you need to get a bead on whether your reactions are actually being fueled by your experiences or your unconscious reading of those experiences. For example, a study by Lorna Campbell, Jeffrey A. Simpson, and others showed, through a series of experiments, that anxiously attached people are much more likely to perceive greater conflict in their relationships on a day-to-day basis, more likely to report feeling hurt or sensitivity, and more likely to be negative about the future of their relationship than those who were not anxiously attached. Questions to ask yourself. Are your childhood scripts feeding your daily adult dialogue? Is your partner really as unreliable as you think? And is the relationship really as rocky as you think it is at moments? Or are you making drama by being overly sensitive and reactive? Are your fears of getting hurt or misled making you push off from your partner? Are you taking your cues from the past or the present? How is your attachment style affecting your relationships? Research shows that our attachment styles don't just play out in the bedroom, but, more importantly, affect how we deal with crises, large and small. How does attachment affect our behavior when someone lies to us? We might as well start there, since the number one torpedo to relationships and the leading cause of divorce remains infidelity at almost 22%, as a study by Paul R. Amato and Denise Previti showed. Most of us assume that the immediate and ultimate death blow to a relationship is one person's deception, especially about something important. But research shows otherwise. Only about 23% of relationships founder directly after the discovery of deception, and it turns out that attachment style plays a key role. That's what a study conducted among college students by Su-Lan Jang, Sandy W. Smith, and Timothy R. Levine set out to examine, using a narrow definition of deception. A case in which a person produces a message with the intent to mislead a relational partner about a matter of some consequence to the partner or the relationship. What they looked at is way beyond the white lie and includes intentional activity as well. It'll surprise no one that in this crisis, securely attached individuals address the issue with their partners directly and, as a result of these communications, were unlikely to end the relationship on the spot. Talking is constructive, and while it may not defang the pain of deception, it helps the victim gain perspective. The anxiously attached talked around the issue, but they too were unlikely to split that second. It was the avoidance, some 45% of them, who were saying au revoir immediately, leading the investigators to conclude that avoidance terminate relationships most often, as they tend to avoid the personal after relational troubles. It seems that it is not important what exactly is said. It is important that couples not stop communication altogether after the discovery of deception. Questions to ask yourself. How does your attachment style shape your response to crisis or betrayal? How does it affect your ability to communicate with your partner? Do you tend to talk around issues, or are you capable of addressing them directly? Do you simply consign the crisis to elephant in the living room status and avoid discussion entirely? Becoming mindful of your and your partner's behavior in conflict. In hindsight, and no, I didn't see it until after we split up, my ex revealed himself when we disagreed on anything, big or small. I couldn't voice an opinion without his laughing at me, rolling his eyes, trying to make me back down. When I didn't, he'd belittle me, call me dumb, tell me he was sick of my endless complaints. If that didn't work, he'd leave the room. Over time, I got braver, and he got more abusive. It took 12 years, but I finally reached a tipping point. Erin, 48. Securely attached people are more able than their insecurely attached counterparts to successfully de-escalate, negotiate, and resolve all manner of conflicts, from small emotional flare-ups to outright warfare. It helps, of course, that they have a positive view of both themselves and others, which facilitates a willingness to explore solutions, a belief that the other person will do his or her best to be honest and direct, and a general optimism about the value of close connection and intimacy. They're better at applying their emotional intelligence, allowing their emotions to inform their feelings and their feelings inform their thoughts when there's a conflict. They are also better at leaving a sinking ship when they identify one. Because insecurely attached people have skill deficits when it comes to managing negative emotion, one way of pinpointing your and your partner's attachment styles is to focus on how you disagree or fight. Marital expert John Gottman has long made the point that he can predict with 95% accuracy whether a marriage will survive based on how a couple fights, not whether they do. Ask yourself the following questions about yourself and then about your partner in an effort to further distinguish your attachment styles. Does discussing tender issues on which you and your partner disagree make you anxious? Are you overcome by fears that your disagreement will escalate out of control? Are you generally inclined to let sleeping dogs lie and avoid discussion and a possible confrontation as much as possible? Who is more likely to initiate a discussion, no matter how difficult, about something in the relationship? Are you able to stay calm in a discussion, or do you get defensive or aggressive almost immediately? Are you likely to be goaded more by your partner's active response or by his dismissing you? Do you stonewall in fights? If so, how does your partner respond? Do you recognize toxicity when you see it? Not long ago, I got a message from a reader who asked, "Can you be in a toxic relationship without knowing it?" Well, yes, it's possible for insecurely attached women who have grown up with toxic treatment to normalize certain behaviors because they're used to them. Have you ever noticed how easy it is to go blind to familiar things in your surroundings? How you stop noticing the pile of boots and shoes by the back door if it's been there long enough, or how your eyes can glide over the clothes hung on the exercise equipment without noticing them. These are mundane and homely examples of how we all sometimes normalize disorder. When you grow up with toxic behaviors, the verbal put-down, the silent treatment, the nasty humor that's meant to make you feel small, it's not unusual to get so used to them that you don't even consciously register them. That can remain true even in adulthood. The familiar feel of various kinds of abuse is further complicated by the fact that the insecurely attached daughter is also prone to misreading the cues in relationships, interpreting a roller coaster type of connection with an avoidant person as highly passionate, mistaking controlling behavior as stable and focused, or not recognizing emotional manipulation when she experiences it. Among the behaviors an unloved daughter who's not yet connecting the dots between past and present may miss are the following. Feel free to change the pronouns from masculine to feminine because these patterns are not gender-based and pertain to all relationships, not just romantic ones. He discounts or marginalizes your feelings. One of the most consistent mantras of the unloving and verbally disparaging or abusive parent is, "You're too sensitive," and it's one of the easiest to believe and internalize. Emerging into adulthood, many daughters simply take this as a truth about themselves, and when their partner or love interest uses the same or similar words, they often acquiesce. These words, or ones like them that suggest you're exaggerating or are a drama queen or thin-skinned, should be a wake-up call that you've found yourself back in your childhood room in a very real sense. He treats you with contempt or belittles you. You might not even notice it because you grew up hearing it, but contemptuous language and gestures aren't part of a healthy relationship. That includes eye-rolling, sneering, or laughter meant to intimidate you or denigrate your responses or even your complaints, or speaking to you with heavy sarcasm. It's funny that you, of all people, would have the nerve to tell me to be a better listener. Or, since when are you an expert on relationships? These behaviors might be even harder for an insecurely attached woman to spot if they are used only intermittently or at moments of discord, which makes it easier for you to rationalize the behavior. He withdraws when you make a demand. This most toxic pattern of connection is so widely recognized by psychologists that it actually has its own acronym, DMW. Demand withdrawal is often a pattern between daughter and mother, especially when the child gets old enough or has the courage to confront her mother. In this pattern, and I am drawing from memory here, the daughter asks the mother why she's treating her badly, and the mother withdraws and denies that it's happening, says nothing at all, or says, "I will not talk about this," and leaves the room. This is a relatively rare pattern among the securely attached because they understand that give and take is part of the process of connection, but it is common among the insecurely attached. The pattern not only cuts off discussion, assuming that the demand is a legitimate one that addresses a need one person has, but also has escalation built into it, since the person making the demand will likely become more frustrated, and the louder she gets, the more her partner will withdraw. By the way, although men sometimes take on the demanding role, studies show it's more likely that a woman will be in this position. Each party feels aggrieved in this scenario. If every discussion you have with your partner devolves into an argument with the DMW pattern in place, you need to be looking for an exit. He manipulates your insecurities. Another legacy of an unloving mother is deep-rooted insecurity about one or more aspects of the self, which can coexist with real-world success and achievement and is easily triggered. "I'm really self-conscious about my weight," Maggie confided. "And in my last marriage, whenever I complained about anything, my husband would fight back by hassling me about how much I ate, or how I looked fat, or how other women looked so much better than I did. It took therapy for me to see the pattern. He wanted me to be docile, and when I wasn't, he attacked me. He projects his feelings onto you. Does this scenario sound familiar? You are supposedly discussing why he's so against getting a new stove when the oven hasn't worked in months, and you can see that he's folded his arms tight against his chest and that he's working his jaw muscles, and you ask him why he's angry. Instead of answering, he turns toward you and accuses you of being angry, not just now, but all the time. And he keeps on going until it turns into a full-blown tirade about how angry and dissatisfied you seem, and he's sick and tired of the same old tattoo. Narcissists project their feelings in this way. In his book, Rethinking Narcissism, Dr. Craig Malkin calls it playing emotional hot potato. But so do other people who simply do not want to, or won't, acknowledge and take responsibility for their feelings. This is, in part, a defensive strategy to deflect blame and fault from one party to another, and it's both toxic and manipulative. He always needs to be in control. Unloved daughters typically lack the sense of belonging that comes naturally to someone who was raised by a parent or parents who made her feel safe and good about herself. Unfortunately, these daughters are often drawn to men who appear to offer a safe haven. They may seem very sure of themselves, are often successful and driven, are outspoken in their opinions and beliefs, because they mistake control for strength and resolve. Because feeling powerless may be familiar and echo childhood, a daughter may be slow to recognize that she's being robbed of her own voice and manipulated into making choices she really doesn't want to make. Control can also be exercised with stealth and a light touch as, for example, when one partner consistently surprises the other by changing plans the couple had previously agreed on. Rejection sensitivity and reacting to the present as if you're stuck in the past. How good are you at figuring out what makes you act and react? You've already identified your basic attachment style, secure, anxious, preoccupied, dismissive, or fearful, avoidant, and it's important to distinguish those behaviors that are driven by your emotional history. If you are anxiously attached, one such pattern is rejection sensitivity. Of course, all humans are hurt by social rejection. We're creatures who need to belong. And studies show that the pain of social rejection engages precisely the same neural circuitry as physical pain. It turns out that the word heartache is much more literal than not. That said, anxiously attached people are much more likely to have high degrees of rejection sensitivity, which works to shape their behavior in complicated ways. The term rejection sensitivity immediately calls to mind romantic rejection, that exquisite pain when someone you love leaves you. But in fact, that's just one component. This sensitivity affects a person on many different levels, influencing her expectations about interactions large and small, and eliciting complex behaviors. The scale developed by researchers Geraldine Downey and Scott Feldman for use in experiments with college students covered a broad range of situations involving the potential for rebuff, ranging from the relatively benign, asking to borrow a classmate's notes, asking your parents for extra spending money, asking a professor for extra help in a course, to ones that involve more personal rejection, asking someone you don't know for a date, approaching a close friend to talk after you've upset him by saying or doing something, asking a friend for a favor, to situations that, should they end in rejection, could really pack a wallop, asking your lover to move in with you, asking your boyfriend if he really loves you, asking someone close to talk to you after a bitter argument. Again, these examples were developed for college students, but they can be adapted for adult life in most cases. The respondents were asked both how worried they were about how the other person would respond and how they thought the other person would react. Needless to say, all of these scenarios were more fraught for those high in rejection sensitivity than those who worried less about rejection. Other studies have tracked the effect of rejection sensitivity on intimate relationships. One by Geraldine Downey, Antonio Freitas, and others hypothesized that people high in rejection sensitivity would actually get tangled up in a self-fulfilling prophecy. Their focus on possible rejection would elicit outsized and combative reactions to the slightest hint of it, and that, in turn, would make lovers and friends head for the hills. And that's exactly what the researchers found. So if you're sensitive to the possibility of rejection, here are some questions to ask yourself. If there's drama in the relationship, how much of it is instigated by you? Do you tend to be drawn to people who make your anxiety more acute? Do you often find yourself in the pleaser role? Can you trace your sensitivity back to childhood experiences? How often do you fight with friends and partners? Do you see a pattern? What kind of reassurance do you demand of your partner when you've been triggered? Do you escalate your demands? Would you like to change your behavior? Doing an inventory of your relationships. Part of the work of distinguishing includes looking at how many relationships in your life appear familiar, incorporating combat, verbal abuse, manipulation, or dismissiveness, and make you feel just as you did in childhood. Understanding why you are attracted to these people in the first place, the fake comfort of the familiar, the fact that their treatment confirms so-called truths you were told about yourself when you were growing up, the echo of older patterns as you have to prove yourself worthy of their love, is the first step in getting yourself to a place where you can begin to work on changing. Think about the following. Why are you in the relationships you're in? Do you always play the same or a similar role in your relationships? What is that role? Can you imagine a relationship that would make you happier than the one you're in now? What would it look like? What kind of a partner would you like to be able to choose or find for yourself? What characteristics would this person have? Looking toward disarming your default settings. In the next chapter, Making the Unconscious Conscious, we'll be looking at specific strategies and techniques you can learn to begin the process of healing and become more skilled at connecting in new, more consciously aware ways. To live differently and with greater emotional ease and contentment, you have to head in that direction. Chapter 6. Making the Unconscious Conscious. My wake-up call came when I realized I didn't even like the people I thought I loved. I was trying so hard to win my mother's approval, mostly unconsciously, through people I loved or were friends with. Invariably, my mother would say how much better these people were and how much smarter they were than me, which set up competition on so many levels. In the end, I didn't even like these people because it seemed I wasn't even in the equation. I kept choosing people to get my mother's approval, and they were just like her. I can see that now. Clarissa, 40. Perhaps one of the most frustrating things about the journey of recovery is that, often, it feels as though you're trying to move a 5-ton pachyderm by yourself. Yes, the proverbial elephant in the living room. But sometimes he's there, and sometimes he's not. Unloved daughters actively complain about how long it takes to recognize the lack of maternal love, how it takes even longer to see the effects, how slow the recovery process is, and how these patterns can be resistant to even years of therapy and efforts at self-help. There are reasons it's hard, and that's what we need to look at first. This chapter is about disarming the unconscious patterns of behaviors, along with the triggers for them, and the reality is, that we can't run the obstacle course until we can see the obstacles. Running the obstacle course. Some of these obstacles, as we'll see, have to do with the brain and apply to everyone, whether they are loved by their mothers or not, but take up a special place in the life of a woman who's actively trying to recover. We'll look at how the brain itself and our unconscious thought processes can be an obstacle and what we can do to outwit them. And yes, those unconscious processes can be successfully gamed, which is very good news indeed. In fact, just hearing these sentences is changing the neural connections in your brain. We have the continuing pliability of that extraordinary organ to thank for that. First, though, we have to look at ourselves and our behaviors. Often we are the biggest obstacles to our ability to thrive, the boulders that stand in the way. Why? Because of the core conflict. Our continuing need for our mother's love and approval. I call it the dance of denial, and I was once an expert at it many years ago. It was the only time in my life, in fact, that I actually achieved the status of a prima ballerina. The dance of denial, in my case, went on for just short of 20 years. Understanding and ending the dance of denial. She was on her deathbed, and someone said, "Do you want to tell Linda you love her?" My mother answered, "No." Of course, I rationalized her behavior because it felt better than thinking I wasn't loved. I rationalized her behavior for years, but it never helped my pain. I would tell people that she behaved the way she did because she was sick, because her own mother had been detached, because she was abused. I barely cried when she died. I cried much more when my beloved dog died, in truth. Why did I rationalize? Who wants anyone to know that they were unloved by their mother? I think that on some level, I felt that if my mother couldn't love me, how could anyone? Linda, 57. It's a testament to both the centrality and complexity of the mother-daughter relationship that, for many unloved daughters, the recognition of their wounding and its source comes late in life. Some women are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and even 60s, and often are mothers or even grandmothers themselves, before they finally begin to understand how their mother's treatment of them in childhood has affected and continues to shape their lives. Others know at a very young age, as I did, that their mothers didn't love them. They know it long before they can even put it into words. I was no older than 3 or 4. Others say they knew it 6, 7, or 8. But this early knowledge doesn't necessarily bestow an advantage, because these children are clueless about why their mothers don't connect to them. In fact, they are very likely to blame themselves for whatever might be wrong, which adds another layer of emotional confusion. Additionally, their perceptions don't stop them from trying to become the kind of daughter their mother would or might love. But they know, deep inside nonetheless. And as they get older, they begin to wrestle with the problem. Note the word begin, because this is a long process, even with therapy. What gets in the way of a daughter seeing her mother's behavior as hurtful, destructive, or even willful? Part of it is certainly the hardwired need for a mother's love and approval that is part and parcel of every infant's being. This need doesn't appear to have an expiration date. It lasts long into adulthood and, perhaps, the entire lifespan. Along with the need, there is often a feeling of deep shame at being unloved, and the deep-seated fear that a mother's judgment is correct. That fear, that her mother is right, that she is ultimately unlovable, and the shame that accompanies it, underlie much of a daughter's denial. Denial puts her in the position of somehow having to make sense of the relationship, of trying to find a reason other than her own unworthiness for her mother's lack of love. Looking for a reason can keep you dancing, as Kate wrote. I rationalized how my mother behaved toward me until last year when I turned 37. I wanted there to be a reason for how she treated me, one I could actually get my head around. I don't think you ever want to admit what's going on when you want so desperately to be loved by your mother. The core conflict can keep a daughter stuck for years. Sometimes the wake-up call, the moment when the rationalization and denial finally stall out, comes when the pain of rejection becomes too much to bear. Sometimes the level of havoc in the daughter's life, wrought by the behavior she's learned in response to her mother's treatment, gets to be too much, and in the moment, she suddenly has the clarity of mind to track the chaos back to its source. That was certainly true for Deidre, whose epiphany happened in her late 30s, after she'd been in two emotionally abusive relationships in a row. It was her marrying someone who treated her just as her mother did that forced her to take a long, hard look at her choices. She ended up going into therapy and ultimately divorced both her husband and her mother within a 2-year period. As she put it, "My mother wasn't able to take responsibility for her actions, and I was no longer in a place where I was willing to tolerate either her denial or the emotional abuse. It still makes me sad, but I had to learn to live differently." Sometimes it's a third-party intimate, a friend, a lover, a spouse, who opens the door to seeing the pattern, as Jen's story makes clear. "I was living with the man I ended up marrying, and we invited my mother to dinner to celebrate my getting my master's degree. He'd met her before, but never one-on-one in this way, in an intimate setting. It was the same old thing with her, but when she left, he turned to me and said, 'Was this beat-up Jen Day? I thought we were celebrating.' Then he went on to rattle off every criticism and lousy thing she'd said about me. My flat looked slovenly. I'd gotten fat. Did I think I was really going to succeed outside of school? And I burst into tears, because I realized I was so used to her being that way that I just sponged it up. He encouraged me to go into therapy, and I did. Unfortunately, my mother didn't want to take responsibility for anything, so we are long estranged. It's a pity, really." Is it any wonder that unloved daughters deny in order to unconsciously protect themselves from recognizing such a painful truth? Yes, that's a rhetorical question. The dance of denial is also energized by the myth that all mothers are loving, and the rationalization that drives the dance is fed by other people's responses. The people who tell you, as they tell me, that it couldn't have been so bad because you turned out just fine, or stop complaining, you had a roof over your head. My own thoroughly unscientific take is that people want so badly to believe that one kind of love is immutable, unconditional, and never wavering, given that we all know love in the world is hard to get and harder to hold on to, that they're resistant to giving up that belief. An unloved daughter's story challenges that pastel-tinted vision of the all-loving mother, and there's the biblical commandment to boot. And it's not just the outside world's reactions that keep a daughter stuck. Speaking up and recognizing the truth of a mother's behavior may be made harder by other family members who either don't see the mother in the same way or don't want to come out and call her behavior what it is. The dilemma that Julia, 41, faces has much to do with her family's rallying in their own dance of denial. "My mother's behavior is still excused by my siblings, and they hate me for telling the truth. They explain and excuse her as a victim because of her own upbringing and are quick to tear me down if I challenge the family in any way. This throws me into self-doubt once again and makes me feel guilty about my perceptions. I'm still afraid of being punished in some way for thinking these thoughts about the person who gave me life. But I know what happened and what she did. I ended up spinning emotionally." The moment at which the daughter stops denying and starts looking is the first step of what is a long journey. unraveling the ways in which her own behavior was shaped in childhood. Coming to terms with the self and experience requires self-compassion, insight, and emotional fortitude, which, of course, denial does not, and a decision about how to use and process both the information gleaned and the experience. This is what Laura came to understand. I rationalized my mother's behavior all of my life. I always had an excuse or a rationale for why she said or did things. This was all about minimizing me, because if there were a reason for her behavior, somehow it was okay. Eventually, after getting out of the blame cycle and ignoring all the New Age garbage about forgiveness, I decided on honesty and accountability. As long as I was excusing, rationalizing her behavior, I was discounting what it did to me, condoning it as okay because I didn't deserve any better. Aha! It took a while to figure this one out. I'm 59. I'm a mother myself, so I'm tired of being on a pedestal or in the gutter. It's not just that the unloved daughter truly gets to see her mother once she stops the dance of denial, but that she is finally afforded the opportunity to see herself in full, unobscured by the second-guessing, self-doubt, and shame that looking away from the real problem induces. For many, it's a hard path, but it is a hopeful one, as Alicia wrote. We are filled with so much self-doubt that loving ourselves and having belief in our worth is so hard. For so long, we believed the trouble lay within ourselves. As a mother myself now, there isn't a thing I wouldn't do for my kids, and I won't put a price tag on it. Loving my kids unconditionally has let me see that I am actually a much more capable and stronger person than I ever knew. If you are still on the Ferris wheel, making excuses for your mother, cutting her slack, trying to minimize your own pain, you aren't being compassionate to her. You are simply lacking in self-compassion. In order to begin the process of healing yourself, you have to let go of the denial and trade it for recognition. Yes, it hurts. Why it hurts was put eloquently in an email by Deborah, 55. When I stopped making excuses for her, I also gave up the hope that things would ever change, that she would come around someday. That was a killer. More like experiencing a death, really. It is the step, though, that every unloved daughter must take to save herself, whether she decides to remain in contact with her mother or not. The feeling of being less than. The degree to which unconscious processes govern much of human behavior will be made clear later. Keep in mind, though, that while some of these unconscious patterns are universal default settings, the unloved daughter has some that are specific to her experiences. Feeling less than or inadequate, which can impair the ability to assess herself realistically despite outward success, is one. The habit of self-criticism, ascribing setbacks or failures to fixed character traits instead of circumstances, is another. There are others we'll turn to in detail after examining unconscious process generally. The brain. Yours, mine, and everyone's. All of us pride ourselves, yes, I count myself in that number, on making well-considered decisions most of the time, and avoiding snap judgments based on little or no information. We think of ourselves as thoughtful and reasonable, but nothing could be further from the truth. Humans are actually hardwired to make snap judgments, or engage in what Daniel Kahneman has called fast thinking, most of which takes place outside of consciousness. Fast thinking that is automatic, you're connecting the dots even as your brain registers that there are dots, was obviously an evolutionary advantage at a time in human history when staying alive required being alert and proactive in the face of physical dangers and challenges. Remember the example in the first chapter about reacting to a baby's cry, even if you don't have a baby, before you've consciously registered there's a baby wailing? Our brains still work that way, which factors into the mix when we consider the road to recovery and disarming the responses we learned in childhood. While I won't provide a comprehensive review of all the automatic processes associated with the brain, I'm going to focus on the ones that most directly affect how we can begin to unlearn what we learned as children. The effects of primes and priming. Did you know that if you have people think about a library, they're more likely to lower their voices to a whisper? Or that the smell of cleanser in the air actually encourages people to clean up after themselves? A body of research attests to the fact that cues in the physical environment evoke specific thoughts and reactions without our being aware of their provenance, or even that we're being cued to do and think what we're doing and thinking. It's not hard to see the evolutionary advantage to the brain metaphorically sniffing out danger before it's actually seen. But this trait continues to influence our behavior in important ways. For the insecurely attached daughters, those unnoticed primes are a key to disarming reactivity. Let's take a look at how primes and priming work. In one experiment conducted by John Barge and Tanya Chartrand, participants who were primed to complete sentences with words associated with rudeness, such as aggressively and bold, were more likely to behave rudely than those primed with neutral or polite words like respect and courteous. Similarly, it's been shown that the physical environment, objects, can cue behavior as well. For example, Barge and his colleagues ran an experiment that used images associated with capitalistic enterprise, a conference table, briefcases, dress shirts, and ties, to see if they could cue competition among the participants. Primed with images of business, 70% of those given the fragment C, blank, blank, P, blank, 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 T-I-V-E, completed it as competitive, compared to 42% of unprimed subjects. Alternatively, the fragment could have been completed as cooperative. Other cues elicit other reactions. A study by Adam Pazda and his colleagues showed that women were more likely to judge a woman as promiscuous or sexually receptive if she was wearing a red dress, and more likely to display jealousy and mate-guarding behavior than if she were wearing white or green. So, if you're sitting at a bar or at a party with your honey, and you suddenly find yourself bristling at the brunette in red, it's your brain doing the talking. If you think about primes and priming in a down-to-earth way, it makes a great deal of sense. We're not reacting just to primes in the environment. The crowded subway car elicits one mood, the calming celadon walls of a sunlit living room another, but also to people's facial expressions and body language. Sometimes we're conscious and aware of how we're being affected, but sometimes we're not. Imagine you are meeting someone for the first time. You've arranged to meet her in the lobby of a building, so there aren't any external primes to elicit your responses. Let's say you call out her name as you approach, and she doesn't smile at you or extend her hand. Do you assume you've done something to offend her, or do you think she's having a bad day and her behavior has nothing to do with you? What if she extends her hand in greeting, but her face is stiff and unsmiling? Are you likely to read into her mixed signals and feel as though you have to do something to win her over? What if she's on the phone and she keeps on talking for the next 10 minutes? Would you register that she's being unspeakably rude, or would her behavior make you feel small and inadequate? For all of us, daily life is made up of dozens and dozens of such moments when we're responding to cues from strangers, acquaintances, neighbors, friends, co-workers, and intimates. Understanding how we react to these cues is part of the journey of understanding that compromises making unconscious conscious. Seeing whether or how you internalize external cues is an important first step in disarming unconscious process. How reactive to cues are you? All this talk of primes may make you feel that we're all human puppets on strings, but the reality is that some of us are more open to their influence while others are relatively impervious. You need to identify your own reactivity, both to disarm primes and to